this room. S26. So after the 3 o'clock onwards we go there. Mullins is where, yeah. Okay, for Rodson and Mullins we come here and then we go over to S26. Right? Mr. Mini, thank you very much. Those were just some housekeeping things. As I indicated to you outside, take us through your CV very briefly, 4 or 5 minutes, very informal. And then members would pose questions to you. I did indicate to you the most important question is about your love life. Thereafter, things relax. Okay, so in your hands, thanks very much.
Thank you very, very much, members, Honorable Chairperson. I just want to start off by, I suppose, Honorable Member Dean Smart is showing the true colors. And I wish I had worn my green jacket as well, just to congratulate the Springboks on the achievement. And I believe that the entire House today will be honoring them. So I would like to add my voice there as well. I grew up in Guguletu. I was born and bred here. My primary degree, I suppose, was obtained at the University of Cape Town. And where I went on to then to do a teacher's diploma where I taught for 3 years after that. But the passion for me has always been with media. And I think when I began to enter into the sector, it was at a time when I suppose there was this desire to see the freedom of the airwaves and also have media being accessible to all of us, to everybody. And I think those days already, there was this call for the broadening of media, community media in particular. And that's been my life. That's where I've been all my life, dedicated to that, to the development of community media. I became a founder member of Bush Radio. I, through my work with the Institute for Democracy in South Africa, I started off a series which basically highlighted the particular changes that have been taking place in this country through a project which I helped to start, which is called Democracy Radio. And thereafter, I became a fully-fledged, I suppose, development radio journalist and also dabbling in a bit of print media as well. But my focus has always been on looking at how we can ensure that media is accessible to all South Africans. I have all my life resisted, and I still am resisting going to mainstream commercial media. There are a number of reasons for that. As you can see in my CV, I've always been the one who believes in the development of the sector, the one who has ensured that whatever development takes place through training, through capacity building, through reaching in particular people in communities in rural, furthest away from the city of Cape Town, and ensuring that whatever we do, we reach those people. Then, of course, I also worked for a health NGO where I was doing something similar as well, where, again, using accessible media, those multimedia, both radio and a bit of print, where, again, the addressing, you know, the flagship then at the time was ensuring that people have a clear understanding as to what it is that we're talking about with regards to primary health care. Then, of course, I wanted to access this more. I went on to work for an organization called Interfund, where I was then rubbing shoulders with the major funders in Southern Africa, where the idea was to make sure that, again, there is, in fact, enough research going back into the development sector. Then I spent some time also working for for an Africa-wide organization, which was called One World, where I was editor of a website. Again, that website, again, was giving, resources and assisting other journalists who are trying to highlight issues around HIV and AIDS. And so I worked for there for a year. I also spent some time with the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation. And again, I there again, we're kind of looking at the post-TRC and saying, what is happening? I spent a year as well working for an organization called JACNET, Gender Education Network Training, and my primary role was to see how we could, in the face of violence against women, in the face of, I suppose, challenges that women are facing, and how we change the mentality of men in particular, and how we work with men. And I was spearheading that project where I worked with a group of men throughout the country, government departments, taking them through workshops, looking at our own masculinities, asking questions about how do we change the face of what's happening. And then, of course, I just recently spent a year working for the department, provincial department of community safety, again, where I was heading up the communications within the department. Right now, I am back in the sector, embracing it fully. We just started an interesting project with an organization that is working with farm workers, women on farms. That's what I'm busy doing now, setting up an exciting newspaper which will be written and edited and produced by women working in farms in the entire area that cover the whole Poland and looking over areas like Paarl, Stellenbosch. That is what I'm currently doing, amongst other things, which includes training and capacity building.
Mr. Vigny, may I just ask, I've listened with such interest, you are a board member of the Quaker Peace Movement. How is that similar or different from effectively the Quaker Church? And then it seems to me you're a very committed person. You are devoted to many causes. But the thing I was listening out for was whether there was, and I got, I think, a confirmation, also a real commitment to the idea of media themselves. The only thing I would like to establish is, you said in so many words that you have all your life avoided the mainstream commercial media. Fair enough. But I just want to get a sense of whether your commitment to the idea of media and communication and diversity and so forth, whether that does stand sufficiently separate from those causes which you espouse, for you also to take an interest in little commercial media. Because, you know, simply if one accepts that commercial media has its own inbuilt democratic mechanism, I mean, if people aren't buying your product, then it means, you know, then it's not working. That is your market, that gives you your basis for drawing advertising. It's a good democratic mechanism. Whereas the one danger with a community model is that simply issues and ideologies or whatever would be pushed. So I would just, the only thing I would like to establish is whether your commitment to the idea of small media would also embrace the commercial ones.
Let me start with my Quaker interaction. That came out of the desire, I suppose, to see peace being established in various communities in the Western Cape, where there was, I suppose, not only just taxi violence or violence that emanated within the hostels, but actually within among the community members as well. I am not a member of the Quaker Church. However, I saw the ideals, the goals, particularly the objectives to see peace being established. And I just wanted to align myself in my own involvement to what extent can I, in fact, interact with communities at board level and preach about this gospel, so to speak, of peace. The reason why I just come to your second question, I suppose the reason why I have avoided, so to speak, the commercial media when I said that somehow tongue-in-cheek, is essentially that, you know, there's a dichotomy which we have created in this country between established media, and when we say established, in that sense we mean commercial media which has out all these millions and advertising and all of that. And I've always felt that the models that you want to create should be the one that come out of a dialogue between emerging community media and commercial media, where this kind of dialogue speaks about what are the strengths, what is it that you can build from emerging communities, emerging community newspapers, radio stations, etc., where not only the issues emerge, but also how do we sustain the sector. In essence, what we've seen people, you know, being sucked, so to speak, out of the sector, you know, into, you know, well-qualified, with good skills, people moving out of the sector into the commercial field. And I've always felt that what we need to do, we need to change our approach and find out what dialogue is there to ensure that those who are in the emerging community media stay and enrich it, enrich much more people so that people have access to media in the lines, I mean, in the same vein as the vision of the MDDA, which speaks about each and every South African will have access to a range of media. And I think in order for us to keep that alive, one doesn't go against the other. However, a dialogue out of that must emerge so that we have an emerging but also well-sustained community media in South Africa. And that's where I'm kind of, you know, said that in tongue-in-cheek, largely because there is a desire in all of us in the sector to see how we can take the sector even forward. You know, looking at various models, both here and elsewhere, overseas and other countries.
Jefferson, thanks. I guess Mr. Mini will always be regarded as a kind of an activist, that we've seen some of them that just, we don't always understand how their mind works. That, you know, when they, why don't you go into the mainstream where you can make money? You know, and then... No, I agree. Let me rather say, start off. I know Mr. Mini pretty well. It's the first time that we've interviewed him. Secondly, I need to admit, 3 weeks ago, I'm not even aware that he's involved with it. I went to Women on Farms, a project, to get literature, get material. With myself and some other members of parliament crisscrossing the Western Cape province in the rural areas, informing and empowering farm workers. But ourselves don't have that kind of material, not even the GIS can provide us with that material. I approached Kusato, they advised me to go to Women on Farms. And alas, I got tons of material, so when we do have our meetings, we distribute it amongst them about rights and just all of that. I subsequent then learned that the meaning is also involved in that project. I must admit I was not aware at that time after I took the material from that site. And one thing that we realized is there seems to be enough diversity on a grassroots level of community radio. I think we'd be picking up speed there. But even if you look at that community radio, they tend to also to lean to the commercial side. I think again because your advertisers kind of direct them into that. Very little, if any, is about farm workers. Secondly, the same with the print. There's hardly any print. That I think that has been distributed at a price or free around farm workers. And very often you hear their stories only after they've been evicted, only after they've lost their job, for a number of reasons, not putting blame to any person. How do you see yourself playing that role where there is like nothing in terms of the print, nothing in terms of farming areas? Secondly, to somehow, through the MDA, persuade the community radios to have a bias towards a particular class. Jefferson, then I just need to... this is my last question. I hope it's not a negative one. Your involvement, you know, Eastern Cape, when I was some time ago around your age council, all of that, lately there's some, you can just inform us if you know what is happening. It seems to be not the best in terms of coordinating and turning out information around AIDS, the fight against it, the kind of information that goes out. It seems that we don't have a good message, particularly on the Eastern Cape coming out, and I'm not saying the other province are not, but they seem to be hitting the headlines for all the wrong reasons. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. I think the issue for me, firstly, just to answer the question, I think one of the challenges faced by the MDDA, over these 5 years, there's been a number of issues. I mean, for example, one of them is that, which I've already mentioned, it's got to do with the, you know, the exodus of skills from the to the limited budget that the MGTA has in terms of its goals and what it's, you know, hoping to achieve. And secondly, of course, is the matter that I've been watching quite closely, print media in particular, where there's supposed to be this partnership, the spirit of the MGTA and what is established there. And I think print media, particularly established print media, has been slow to come on board. It's been kind of hesitant. And that's why then, you know, the new act, which is essentially now ensuring, I mean, Section 89 of the Electronic Communications Act speaks about how these established entities will give a certain percentage towards the MGTA, I call it 0.2 in terms of the annual turnover, so that that money can be planted alongside, you know, the other existing what used to call Universal Access Agency, you know, USASA as it is called now. And the idea then is to ensure that you make the work of the MGTA much more smoother and much more easier, so that then you begin to speak to communities as well as established commercial editors, that they need to play a particular role in ensuring that print media is run out, I mean, is rolled out as much as possible to communities, and that communities come on board, you know, quite easily. At the moment, I mean, I think there has been, you know, this call to say, how do we strengthen the MGTA on the one side, but also the other side is to say, how do we then engage quite fiercely, I suppose, those who are established to play the role of developing media, community-based media in South Africa. And I think that's the next step, in the next phase, I suppose, of the MGTA, is to see how do we do that. I mean, I think the annual report has pointed that one out clearly. And also, I think the engagement that the MGTA has had with that has been actually to say, you know, be on board and see how you can. And in that way, then, you know, there will be a manner in which you are able to address, you know, these particular challenges. And that process is starting. It's beginning to. And in essence, I mean, I think the president of this country has been at pains in ensuring that, you know, big commercial companies, particularly in media, respond to that call. That's on the one side. I suppose the question around the Eastern Cape and its own challenges, certainly, from my knowledge, the Eastern Cape AIDS Council has had some success in trying to reach communities. But then again, at the same time, the biggest challenge there is found at, you know, because we work at councils, we work with the local authorities, you're working with grassroots organizations, where then the capacity, I suppose the skills in ensuring that the message around HIV and AIDS is carried forward, the insurance, I mean, I suppose the commitment to taking this into communities with ordinary, you know, community radio stations that are found there. And one of the biggest challenges, I suppose, is to increase the spectrum of production and ensure that each and every corner, you know, as we used to shout in the days, that there is, in fact, a community-based media. So, for example, we would use not only just community radio stations or commercial radio stations, but also multi-purpose centers that are found in communities where people are able to access those. At the same time, where we train people to on basic media production and production, where you empower people.
But to me, do you think that we should leave the market really to determine if there's going to be a community print? We've been leaving them for many a year. They don't seem to make any inroads in terms of that. Or do you see that it should be an intervention on a massive scale, something similar to the InfraCo? I know InfraCo has been established for something else, but on that intervention to break through that seems to be a glass ceiling. Do you think that we shouldn't do that, or just leave it to the market to determine that?
Well, someone else was in this particular debate was saying that perhaps maybe we should look at how do we legislate. The big companies, the big bosses, to see how they feel a sense of of attachment to it. Certainly not. I do not think we should leave it to them. I would be making a mistake. My thinking would be that a campaign, I suppose, which is based at grassroots level, should be, should be the rallying call, whereby communities are actually saying, no, this is what we want, this is what we'd like to see. And then I think an engagement of that, and a prolonged campaign in that sense, so that is, it's not only just something that falls and then falls on deaf ear, but however, continues to be a sustained call right through. And I think you're absolutely correct. There is, we would be making a mistake to sit back and hope that something would happen. When we hoped, we've had our fingers bent many, many times. Because let me take an example. There's a village that I love, where my father grew up, where I occasionally go and visit all the time. 2 years ago, I began to ask particular questions in the Eastern Cape, where I asked, where are community media? Who's actually involved in actually highlighting issues around that? And I began, a little initiative where people were beginning to brainstorm these thoughts around that as to how to, because suddenly commercial media is making impact there. However, communities are left on the outside, and so we need to bring communities alongside by asking questions, hard-hitting questions at that. I expect an organization like the MGDA should be assisting communities in not only just, we say these are the plans, but also implementing those kind of plans and ensuring that people come forward with their proposals, with their funding strategies, and capacity building is built into the mission of the MDDA.
Sure, thank you. We almost out of time, so I'll be very brief. Most impressive, but the diversity of your involvement. Just a quick question, your stint at the Western Cape Department of Community Safety. Why did you leave? What was the circumstances about when you left them? And how did you experience that as in contrast with your previous engagement with NGOs and all those other things?
Okay, so thanks very much. I left the department for two reasons. The one is that I wanted to devote a whole lot more of my time, I suppose, in a project which the members already mentioned, because I felt that's where my heart is. And having gained an insight into how government departments work, I was fairly informed in terms of understanding the PFMA, understanding the role of GCIS. I was fairly informed about where government is coming from. that was the one reason. The other reason why I left, I felt that I needed to just finish up my dissertation, my master's, because it was beginning to take a back seat, and I wanted actually to push that as much as possible. So those are the two reasons why I left. Thank you.
Any further questions, members? Okay, thank you. Eddie?
I might not know what has been asked.
No,
my answer will be a broad one. When I was coming in, I hear that there was a mentioning of the ECA, the Electrical Communication Act. I just want to get your broader view, because that act has resulted in a situation where there is a convention, be it in the broadcasting and so on, and also the media itself. What is your view in going forward? Do we really still need two separate institutions, which is your SAFA, the one which is currently there, and the MDDA, or is going forward maybe, what's your view? Because to me it seems as if we might be duplicating two institutions which should be playing one role if they can be merged together, I thought. But I just want your view around it.
Thank you very much. I at some point, it must have been, I don't know, 2 months or 3 months ago, so I began to engage, I suppose, some of my colleagues, you know, in the sector, and we actually discussed that a little bit. At the same time, I also got to know the views that have emanated from the CEO of the MGDA. And one thing, for example, if you compare the performance, first of all, let's take a performance level. If you look at the performance of IFRAS, as opposed to, or comparing that with the MGDA, UTSASA has not been able to achieve. I mean, I was told that they've been able only to go up to 50% of what they were targeting to do, as opposed to the MGDA, which had a total of 20 million rand last financial year, and contrast that with UTSASA's 30 million. Which was given to them. So clearly you can tell who's performing more powerfully than the other. My view is that you have the map sitter, you have I suppose UTSASA, then you also have the Department of Communications. Those are some of the entities that are channeling some money, I suppose, into the development of media in this country. You have also other commercial entities on the side. My take is that actually what the MGDA should do should actually stick to be the structure that seeks to ensure that whatever fund we establish, it actually goes through the MGDA. And I think the MGDA has proved itself to, that it's here. I mean, they've performed well. The internal capacities have been built up in the organization. They have received good reports, financial reports have been done very well. What you need to capacitate the MDA even more staff, more money, more of that. And my take, therefore, is that the MDA should be the lead there, particularly that the ECA actually does speak, as I said earlier, section 89, speaks very clearly about what the role of the MGDA should be in the light of what we're talking about, particularly when you conversion, not only just, electronic media and migrating from one form to another, but actually seeking to see how we can ensure that convergence is there and it's strong. That's my view.
Alright, Mr. thank you very much for your time. And no further questions. So the committee will now deliberate after all the interviews and then make a selection. Thanks very much for your time. Don't give all the answers to Professor Berger. We've got a list of three German questions and Jean knows all the answers. Professor Berger, welcome to the committee. As I indicated to you outside, you'll just talk to your CV for a few minutes, and then members will pose questions. So generally an informal protest, not very structured. People might ask you all sorts of questions, but take it as it comes. And we hope that the interview will be completed in about 30 minutes or so. And thanks for coming earlier, because you made it easier for us. As I said, the candidate is delayed, so we would have had to sit here and wait around. But thank you very much. Over to you.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Portfolio Committee members. Thank you indeed for shortlisting me and for allowing me to come and present what I think I can bring to the NDDA. You may have seen the nomination letter which was signed by a colleague in the media industry, proposing me, Matata Teru. He and I have worked together on media diversity issues for some time, particularly in the South African National Editors Forum. Anyway, in my letter, you'll see from my CV, I have been involved in the alternative press going back quite some time to the early 1990s here in Cape Town, where the whole question of sustainability of the media was very, very prominent, given that this was funded media by the international community, but as society became a democracy, we had to look to survival in the marketplace without funds. At that time, I was an editor, then I also became a business manager, so I had experience of both those sides. I then also was involved in early efforts to set up a precursor to the MDDA called the Independent Media Diversity Trust, which managed to get some, I suppose, like a golden handshake from the international community to try and support small-scale media in South Africa. At that time, the alternative press. Eventually, that institution, the Independent Media Diversity Trust itself, could not be sustained. So I think these are very strong lessons that I learned in all this. In 1994, I then went to Rhodes University to head up the School of Journalism, and that's where I've been since then. And my interest has continued a lot in the whole question of diversity and development. So for several years, I ran short courses teaching media managers how to manage, based on my experience, because as they say, you learn so much from not succeeding. You know, failure is the best lesson, and the fact that some of the media I was involved with did not succeed in the long term was a fantastic laboratory. So I used to run these short courses for editors, business managers, and so on, and eventually we set up the Soul Psyche Media Leadership Institute at the university, which has done some work with the MDDA previously. And that now it's a four-person unit that has its own researcher, and it does a lot of work around these issues of sustainability. In addition to that, I've been quite involved in the question of trying to analyze and research sustainability. So I've done several papers on the question of media density. And media density refers to how much media you have in a society. And of course, you all know that there's the rhetoric around the information society, and a few years ago we had the World Summit on the Information Society. And all this was to highlight the changing nature of the world from an industrial and agricultural world towards an information world. And of course the information world depends on media. Media is the most irregular and consistent and widespread disseminator of information. So I was looking at the whole question of media density from the point of view of, so how big is the media industry? How big can it be? What is international experience here? And how can it help move South Africa, and indeed Southern Africa, into the information age, where there's a proliferation of information? Certainly it would be wrong to talk about information overload in the South African context, because that is not the case for the majority of people. In the course of this research, I found that in the US, for example, they say that media has never been more than 6% of GDP, and also people's household consumption. They've never spent more than 6% on media consumption. Now, that was in the days before the internet. This was in American figures, of course. And it's a very broad statement for the whole of the USA, whereas if you had to look at particular regions like California, you'd probably find that Hollywood contributes much more than 6%. Of GDP, at least in Los Angeles. So it depends what unit you're looking for. At any rate, South Africa is way, way below the 6%. So even if there is some magic threshold that media can never be more than 6%, we are still far from getting to that 6%. So this is where some of the kind of research issues I was looking at. And then, just to sum up, I think more recently, the past 3 years, I've been very much involved in an international movement to promote media development and diversity in Africa. And this came out of the Tony Blair Commission, the Commission of Africa, in which it was recommended that part of African Renaissance would need to be an African media development facility. That was the phrase. It was a recommendation in the Blair Commission. Coming out of that, there have been two big projects. One has been a big research project. What are the obstacles to media development across the whole of Africa? And I was in charge of researching 7 countries, including South Africa, in that project. And parallel to that was a consultation with media stakeholders around the continent that was led by the UN Economic Commission for Africa. Anyway, the long and short is that those 2 initiatives are now completed. They've come together, and I'm so involved now that this combined initiative about promoting media development in the wake of the Blair Commission is meeting in December to look at big projects to now push to international donors to promote media development. And those are projects that would be dealing with policy and regulatory issues, with finance issues, and capacity building issues, training and capacity building. I've been asked to lead the training and capacity building components of this international project. So I do hope that those connections, that experience, would, in a way, be able to feed into some of the work that the MDDA is doing, and also that the MDDA experience can inform the Pan-African initiative to make sure that we can get more resourcing for media development and diversity in Africa, and also that it will be successfully used, that resourcing. There will be something to show for it, you know, in 4 or 5 years down the line. Thank you, Chair.
Question? Chairperson, thanks. Prof, some difficult questions, then I'll come to the easy one. Who won the Rugby World Cup? Who was the highest try scorer? The color of your blood, is it red or green? It's very important for you to be, you know, exact. You might just miss out if you answer it wrong on that one. Media diversity, there seems to be a steady but continuous growth in terms of ID or community radios, and that's all of that. The flip side, the MDA was trying to assist both with print as well as electronic. There seems to be a slow take-up of the print. We've seen the mainstream media has stepped in to a certain extent and has provided that. Like, I think in Cape Town, you have Metro Burger and some other places, you know, doing that. But not the real community papers that you want to see. How do you see yourself within MDDA to offer that assistance to speed up that process where the print takes up its rightful place parallel to the growth of the community radio space? And, or should we just leave it that it would evolve itself? Thanks, Chairperson.
Should I respond now, Chair? Yes. Rugby World Cup. actually, what is significant is, of course, not so much Rugby World Cup, with due respect, but 2010. And what can 2010 do to promote media development and diversity around the country? And how can, from a media point of view, capital be made? How can this event be capitalized upon? And I think that there's a lot of potential there, in particular around the use of new technologies, because by 2010, of course, we will have digital broadcasting through the cell phone. Now, the fact that will become technically possible doesn't mean then people will be encouraged to upgrade their cell phones, because they want to watch 2010 on their cell phones or get the latest information on their cell phones. And to some extent, that could be, I think, a threshold moment in our history where we really begin to exploit cell phones, not just for private conversation, but as information and media devices. Now, that really depends on to what extent a group like the MDDA can begin to encourage all media players and also Greenfield people to start saying, hey, there's a huge opportunity coming with a sports event. How can we begin to make media businesses that will circulate media content sports content in the first instance, but also other content thereafter, really begin to get the public acculturated to seeing itself not as a phone, but as a media device. And of course, not just as a receiving media device, but also as a publishing and interactive media device. So, if you don't mind, I'll just dwell on the rugby, then I'll go on the 2010. The huge importance of the MDDA should play in capitalizing involvement in new media, particularly the conversion of cell phones into media devices. Of course, that electronic communications becomes cheaper and cheaper over time, unlike your newspapers, and also it's very interactive directly, whereas broadcasting is, of course, very important, but the interactive side allows South Africans to become involved in a conversation, not just to be recipients of information. So then, in terms of the MDDA thing, access not just information, but access to becoming a communicator. In terms of the community papers and the metros and that, there is a huge growth internationally of free newspapers, of niche newspapers, suburban newspapers, and so on. I think that MDDA can certainly promote those kind of trends in South Africa, because worldwide the trend is that polls, mainstream daily newspapers are in fact stagnant or declining, except in some countries where, here we have the Sun, in India they have some growth there, but really the long-term thing is that information needs to be free for people to access it, and therefore you need to develop advertising supported models to bring that information to people. And so I think that much as the big groups are seeing some opportunities there, like the Metro Burger, there's still a lot of space to produce, and particularly in your smaller towns, like the one I come from, and even smaller ones, to start promoting those kind of niche-based media where you can provide media free newspapers to people, but supported by advertising.
Would you hang up?
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know whether this question I'm going to ask you is maybe relevant to what you have just said, Professor Verde. But I am bothered about the areas that are in the rural of Limpopo, where a cell phone and any other kind of media is just not the relevant way of giving information to those people. Now, I hear that you have been involved in many projects, such as the United States involved in research in Africa. And I want to know, what do you think we are lacking if you were to be appointed to be on this board? What do you think you can bring to the board so as to address this problem? Because every time we are on interviews, we are talking about nearly the same thing about this area, where people who have cell phones, it's just a futile exercise to have anything in that area. The remote area of Limpopo, there are areas that are like this. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. I don't think there's a magic answer that can solve those issues quickly. However, I would also just remind us that 10 years ago, a cell phone was something for the rich business community in the cities. And today, those most rural areas are still undercovered. But if you look at the penetration of cell phones in other parts of the country, that has really changed. And I think that in time, those we will also find that we do get increasing uptake of cell phones in those areas. Of course, one of the questions there is electrification. And in some cases, there are cell phone signals, but no electricity to charge the phone. Now, in fact, I've been involved in a conference at my university called Highway Africa, where we showcased a young entrepreneur from the Grahamstown Townships. He changed his bicycle, so instead of having a dynamo that lit his lights, he charged his cell phone on his bicycle. Now that kind of project that you can really support with MDDA, how can that kind of small business thing become a popular idea? So in rural areas where you have no electricity, people can begin to charge cell phones with on bicycles. You know, that that is the kind of innovative thinking that I think we need to do. We need to have, and if I, you know, I would certainly be keen to promote those sorts of things in the NVDA. But having said that, as far as cell phones, of course, the biggest challenge for those rural areas is to promote radio and universal access to radio and local community radio. And another NVDA, it has had some work with SABC on increasing the public service radio. That needs to be increased, that work, because SABC, I think, is doing some stuff, but of course SABC has got its mind on, you know, generating enough money to keep going. And that means meeting your urban audiences, you know, and getting advertising and so on and so forth. So I think SABC's attention to rural service delivery and access to signals, SABC signals, needs to get some emphasis, and MDDA can play a kind of advocacy partnership role in that regard. And then, of course, community radio. I think this is where MDDA has been making a difference, if you look at the past few years, and certainly in the rural areas of Limpopo. That's, of course, people need public broadcasting, but to have community broadcasting is extremely powerful. And, you know, MDDA has been looking at trying to get more activities in the different provinces, even, like I said, the Northern Cape, which is a very remote area compared to, you know, even Limpopo is not necessarily as remote as the Northern Cape. And MDDA is making a bit of an impact there. Ultimately, though, I would say that MDDA needs a lot more resourcing if it's really going to make a difference. And, of course, that is a much bigger question. But certainly, if I was on the board, I would see what I could do to help bring partnerships between MDDA and these international media development initiatives, where MDDA might become a sub-agency to do some of the work in these. But I would also encourage MDDA to do research about how can they actually make a case to Treasury via GTAs, of course. How can they make a case that they need more resourcing there? Plus, how can they also make a case to the print media that much as there will be an increase in broadcast revenue thanks to the ECA, how can the print media begin to be encouraged to put more money into the MDDA? Because that's really what's needed in this country. A small budget, you can't do that much with.
Just to say that I think it's great that you're available for that, and the synergies between this Africa-wide work you're doing and the MBDA work sounds like an excellent thing to me, especially if you start talking about accessing some international funding. So I want to ask you a completely different kind of question. In the light of your association with SANEF, and in the light of the fact that the MDDA works with print, what would be your views on proposals that have surfaced on the majority party's website and which are apparently on their way to Polokwane, that there should be such a thing as a tribunal sitting in judgment of the print sector?
Well, I think that, you know, the media in general is very happy to criticize other people but doesn't like getting criticized itself. But, of course, as our former president said, Nelson Mandela, freedom of expression is not the right of the media, it's the right of every individual. So any individual, any organization has complete right to do what they want to do vis-a-vis the media, to critique the media. In fact, there are NGOs that are doing it, and the political parties do that as well. The question is whether a tribunal, then, the idea of a tribunal goes further than just critique and actually becomes a statutory mechanism. That then is, I think, taking things quite a lot further. And overall, I think international experience is that if you really want the media industry to develop, you for the sake of information plurality and diversity, you need to have a light touch regulatory position on the part of a state. And apart from the freedom of expression issues that can be compromised perhaps to some extent if you have more and more state involvement in tribunals about editorial content. But I think because of the general focus on light touch, therefore to promote effective self-regulation is I think the better strategic way to go from the point of view of democracy and development of the media and diversity. I'm not convinced that that there are problems in the self-regulatory system. SANEP is not a regulatory body, by the way. There's the Press Ombudsman and the Press Council. The Press Ombudsman having just been, upgraded with Joe Clawley's position, and the Press Council being added to give more power there. And in fact, Friday there's a conference in Joburg about how to try and give more teeth even to self-regulation in the print media. And then, of course, broadcasting has its own regulation, its self-regulation, as you know. So that is what I would have to say on the tribunal, but I think fantastic. Good to have debate, good to have critique, but I think if we start heading towards a statutory mechanism of regulation, particularly editorial content issues, that to me becomes
objectionable, in Tommy Maguire's words.
Well, I think it's not productive in terms of development and democracy. But if I could just mention something else that has cropped up, which I think is relevant to this question of advertising and the strategic use of advertising. There is a view that, of course, the state should use advertising for strategic purposes, in particular to punish those media that are causing problems from the point of view of government. Other people would say, if you want to take that point of view, in fact, it's all the more reason why you should go and advertise in those media, because you've got to counterbalance their message. But I don't agree with that approach at all, either as a strategic for or against, because I think it's a question of advertising not as a tool for media development or media punishment or media reward. Advertising is a way to get a message out, and therefore it should be treated as a business decision. If the Sunday Times is an effective vehicle for reaching certain audiences with certain messages, good. If not, cut. But we shouldn't confuse or conflate political support or political hostility towards certain media with a business thing about how do you actually get get media done. And if I can just say one thing that I think the MDDA could really look at here, there has been a tendency around the country, even predating the whole Sunday Times issue, of local councils beginning to use advertising in a punitive political way, even in the town I live in. And to me, that is a negative issue in terms of supporting independent and diverse media in a town. It needs to be a business approach as to whether a council is going to support local media. But certainly, from the point of view of MDDA, if it's only going to be advertising for political reasons, I don't think we're going to have diversity in your small town.
Looking at time, so short questions. Dunka, Sam, Eric.
Thank you. It's a follow-up sort of on the question that has been raised. What I want to hear from you, Professor, is your own analysis of the South African print media. What do you think of it? Do you see the parasite? I should not lead you. Just I'll have a follow-up question after you have answered it. Just give me your own evaluation, your analysis of it today.
Mine was short. I wanted to check whether to serve on any other boards.
Mine, I just wanted to check with Prof. What is it which you think MDDA can do? You see, we're talking about these local newspapers and so on in the community, but it would seem there are very few in terms of the indigenous languages. Most of them are English and so on. What do you think will be the role of MDDA around that particular matter? Because for me, it's like we're flooding the market with one thing. There is no diversity in terms of views or alternative for those people who cannot have to be able to access or be able to read English and so on. Thank you.
Prof, you're absolutely right about the vehicle to take out information, and very often the vehicle wanders off and takes up the role or confuse the role of taking out information to that of opposition party in the absence of a strong opposition, and very often they play that particular role. And I can mention one specific incident where
when somebody's file disappeared from the hospital, and I will not mention any names, and there seems to be an occult cover concentration that is of lethal interest, and nobody talks about a crime being committed by stealing or in possession of stolen property, you know, and then the media wanders off in terms of that. I think the time that we find ourselves now is to have cool heads, and normally air is being used to take out a particular message. Coming back to my question, there seems to be change in the print, there seems to be a flat ground, more options, but not very sharp ground, that more readers coming at the same rate as your community readers and just all of that. Exactly because Eric Mwalo said there is not this diversity in terms of language and the process and rural versus urban, you know, those kind of things. The concern obviously is that there's not more readers coming through. We need more people to read the words. If we don't get more people to read, they will all go just electronic, and there's a negative trend in terms of that. How do we see the MDDA playing that role to get more people to read while listening to the radio? That's
Thank you for those questions. Some of them are related, so I can comment and address some of those issues. So South African print media, what do I think of it? The print media is facing more competition than it has ever faced in history, and I think that leads to certain effects, sometimes which, you know, one would not like as a person who believes in media ethics and that quality journalism. And I think we've been in a phase where the most successful newspapers from a circulation point of view have been the tabloids like this one. And I think that has set up a model where many other newspapers have decided, oh, we need to do the same kind of thing. You know, go a more sensational sort of route. But in the end, I think they will realize not everybody can be a tabloid. Those tabloids will do the tabloid stuff and they'll do it. And you know, your selling point needs to be that you're different to them. So I think it'll even out a little bit, you know, over time. But I think we still have this competitive phase within the print industry, within print itself. But of course, there's more and more competition that is coming from broadcasting, new media, internet, and so on. And so the challenge facing the newspaper industry is convergence. And to what extent can MDDA then encourage these one-platform media to start thinking multimedia? Because unless you can start using your content on many platforms, broadcast, online, cell phones, print, you are not going to get the audience that will then bring you the advertising. So I think that the convergence thing becomes a challenge for newspapers that tend to only think of themselves as newspapers. And bit by bit they are getting with it, I think. But your small town newspapers, those are the ones that I think need support to become convergent enterprises. Of course, the print media also, you know, its biggest limitation is that it's primarily in the English language. And, you know, that touches on the questions about how do we promote newspapers in other, in the indigenous languages. And, again, I don't think there's a magic answer here because it depends to some extent on where you are in the country. Obviously, in Soweto, which indigenous language will you choose for your major thing? Yeah, that's true. But when you come to Eastern Cape or KZN, it's Xhosa or it's Zulu. I mean, that becomes easier there, but in some parts of the country, it's not so easy. Then you also have another problem to face, that a newspaper tends to try and be a world public forum. And because of the history of this country, unfortunately, you find some communities, particularly your minority communities, do not speak African languages. And therefore, and if those communities are also involved in the advertising market and so on, you know, a newspaper that's going in Isikosa, for example, has got to convince those people who cannot read Isikosa that actually this is a viable medium for their advertising. Because much as your English is not a lingua franca, in real terms, it tends to be used in newspapers as a common public space, of course, for a limited area of the public. So I think what I'm just trying to say there is that there are constraints with newspapers. I think broadcasting is much easier to do indigenous language communication. But when you come to a newspaper, it's a slightly different animal in terms of its economics, in terms of the role it plays in the community. The best, I think, is that one can you know, aim for multilingual newspapers, which you do have, even in the commercial newspapers, something trying to get some multilingualism in newspapers. Then you, of course, you have to be careful that it's not a ghetto, you know, that's like the old, you know, white news and then the extra news, you know, the white news in English or Afrikaans and the extra news in African languages. You know, so these are complex issues, and I think the MDDA, as far as I can gather, is really keen on promoting indigenous language newspapers, but it's not an easy question. The political role of the newspapers, well, I think part of the competition that we've got in newspapers is that, you know, in the media more broadly, is that skilled communicators are in great demand. And skilled communicators can usually earn a lot more outside of the media than in the media, either in government communications or in corporate communications. So the result is you have really a downskilling of the people involved in the media industry in our country. Because I think the media industry just can't pay those kinds of issues. To give you one very quick example, a senior black editor on the Star newspaper went to join 2010 because the package was something like five times what he was getting on the newspaper. And that newspaper said it couldn't even offer him shares because it's foreign. They couldn't even offer him stock options to try and keep him. So I think the media industry is not structured well enough to really keep people. And then, of course, the planning situation. We're not producing enough skilled people to saturate that market. That's why there's still a scarcity of professional communicators who can command a price email. Anyway, the long and short of it is that I think that we do have problems in the media industry. They are not good skills, basic accuracy, as I'm sure you all know. Certainly, they are not, I think, there's not enough understanding of ethics. And the ethics, the need for journalists to be independent. So, of course, you find in politics now today, in my view, journalists are either, many journalists, are playing political games when they should be more independent, or they are letting themselves be used in political conflict, willingly or unintentionally. And that's partially a function of the, I don't want to say maturity, but let's say the lack of professional development that we have in the industry, where actually, it's in their interest, and in everybody's interest, the media should stay outside of the political sector, but to an extent, in my view. But of course, the freedom of speech. If a particular newspaper wants to support candidate A or party B, that's fine. We cannot stop that. But good professional journalism should at least try and keep some autonomy from the political situation. That's my analysis of why we sit with the situation that we've got. Just the last question to address. I'm not convinced that we have flat growth in newspapers because the tabloids have been, you know, really pumping and continue to pump. And new tabloids will probably come and can also expand. In some ways, it does promote the culture of reading. The defenders of tabloids say that's fantastic. I myself think, well, it is increasing diversity, but I'm not sure that's the kind of diversity that the MDDA should be supporting. The MDDA, I think, has an interest in other kinds of diversity within a broad spectrum of human rights that respect the Constitution, because some of the journals and the tabloids, it's obviously very popular, but it's not something that I think resources from a group like MDDA should be supporting. Much as they're successful businesses, to me, it's not where MDDA should be positioned.
Okay, thank you very much. This interview is a bit like an academic lesson, I would say. Thank you for your time. We'll keep in touch, and you know, we've got a few more to go and probably do a selection in the next few days. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Timothy.
Thank you very much. This is Mr. Google and Siri. We're going to have to be very, very tight with time because we've got to get back to the house at 12 o'clock. And we've got another gentleman also, Mr. Sampanka Matemola, also waiting outside. So, Randy, question and no speeches. Mr. Siri, thank you very much. A few minutes to take us through your CV, and then members would ask questions. And they're unpredictable. They ask all sorts of questions. Over to you. This is Mr. Gugu in CD. Number two.
Is that fine? Okay. I have said hello, Sanibonani, Molweni. I studied journalism. I had always enjoyed writing, so it was the first place that I went to when I finished my O-levels. I went to school in Swaziland. I did my O-levels and my A-levels at a school in Swaziland called Waterford. I then went to go and study journalism. I started at the University of Technology at Natal. I did my journalism there, then went on to the U.S. To do an honors in journalism there. I started working at the SABC, started off as a political journalist, radio science. The first person that I met actually when I started was Cyril Hafiji, who later became a mentor and a friend, and steered me through my journalism career. I then went to, I became an executive producer for AM and PM Live, and was seconded to the Institute for the Advancement of Journalism, which was headed by Hugh Lewin at that time, to train journalists within government and the SADC area. And that's where my exposure to community media began. During the training, there was we got a chance to interact a lot with the public sector because we used to train their spokespeople and their head of media in the different departments. And I suppose that's when I went to the public sector to do my service there. I then went to the State Information Technology Agency as head of public affairs and government relations. I guess the bureaucracy got to me and started a company called Spin Media with two friends in a quest to help communicate better public affairs and government relations. It became bigger than we had ever thought it would be. When we started servicing clients like Prime Media, the SABC, and currently, one of our main clients is to advise Vela Panda and a couple of companies, which I'm quite willing to give you. The list is just very long.
Very much.
Chair, I'll be brief. Just one quick question. In your nomination form, which I presume you've seen, there's remarks by Ms. Mang as to your recent decision to dissolve SPIN.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it said you may not volunteer the information. I just want to know if it's been dissolved.
Yes, I would be willing to. SPIN had been running for about 7 years. We had two shareholders who left to go and live in the UK. Deloitte was in the process of buying SPIN, as with any big entities that involved money, there were shareholder issues, and because two friends of mine and I had started SPIN from scratch, we when we started it was really to have fun and change the communications world. We were not willing to put a price tag on it, so we opted to walk away and do consultancy work and start SPIN from scratch without the other shareholders. So there were, when SPIN grew, we got bigger people to invest in spin, and I guess that's what happens when the company becomes too big, and I guess, you know, the carrot becomes a lot bigger. So those are the reasons we decided to dissolve spin and start it from scratch without the other shareholders, so we had to buy them out.
Finally, I see the faces I get from a John Perlman at a certain point behind the fortune I saw. but my question will be short. I just want to check in terms of your understanding of the workings of MTE. What do you think you are going to add, or with sight, or in terms of the activities of MTE, you think will improve?
Thank you. My exposure to you know, media development, as I said, came when I started working with Hugh Lewin at the Advancement of Journalism at the Institute. And I saw the need in community media and how we forget that there's a huge sector that is left behind in terms of media progression. So I think that the value that I would add, having interacted directly with NCRF and the different community media stations and with the new community television coming through, I think it's to bring an understanding and to bring some exposure, because I think it's the lack of understanding of the role of MDDA that probably gives MDDA the challenges that it has. So I think that my contribution really would be to create an understanding of what MDDA is all about and the needs of the people who are disadvantaged because of their economic shortcomings, lack of a better word.
Thank you, Chair. If I should be critical of the MDDA, what areas would you highlight?
Thank you, Mike. I think that I'd hate to take credit from Mr. Tindin. I think he's done an amazing job. I think that probably from an outsider point of view, what I look in and see, and it's a very comfortable place to be looking out from the outside, is that I don't think that it's explained properly. I don't think that if you walked into Department of Foreign Affairs, or if you walked into Prime Media and asked a senior level person what MDDA was involved in, I don't think they would understand unless they were directly involved in terms of funding and perhaps involved in some of the sectors. But I think that one of the shortcomings that I see are that it's not properly marketed, or you know, the profile of MDDA is not properly explained, and the mandate is not explained, even to the people who need it the most. I don't think they understand what they would, you know, what they would benefit if they were to associate themselves with an organization like MDDA. So it's the exposure, marketing, communications point of view that I would see as a gap. And you must know it was a year's contract. And we applied and we got another year. What that would entail was we did the skills. They didn't have a public affairs manager, Elizabeth Jacobs, right now. So we did the whole communication strategy, meaning drafting the communication strategy for Parliament and advising them that they needed a solid person to handle public affairs for Parliament. That it's an entity that everybody is supposed to have access to, but without having any strategy. So when people have access to it, what does it do? So it was an ABC guide of starting communications from scratch and identifying people who would be relevant in making sure that people understood what Parliament did or does. And we would also arrange for opening of Parliament. And we worked with the Insight, Elizabeth Jacobs team, and Lucille Jacobs at that time.
Definitely not, Mama. I don't think there's enough that's being done. I think that even if
we could say that we had a lot of successes. I don't think you ever get enough of education. I don't think that people need to be educated and educated and educated all the time. I think that if I were to be appointed, I think that it would be an area that, as a woman, because I think that we live in a very patriarchal society in South Africa, and we as females, and excuse me all the men that are here, tend not to have a voice. We tend to take a back seat on talking about issues, particularly violence against women. I wouldn't like to say we become complacent, but I think that historically we've just been a gender that has been more quiet than it should be, and I think that that's the role that I would use to be more open and vocal about it. Okay, thank you very much for giving me the time.
We have to finish at 12 o'clock for two reasons. One is that people get to the house. There's an unscheduled sitting today. And you've got a plane to catch at 1 o'clock. Good. Over to you.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Tom Sangwa, Mulo Thomas Mula. People call me Tammy. As you can see from my CV, I actually haven't been alive that long to have a long story to tell. So I'm not going to keep you too long. As you can see from my CV, I've been around quite a bit. I've done a lot of diverse things. I started off at Varsity in Media, per se. I was in charge of the radio station at that university. And from there, what I was doing there, I was being a presenter, sort of what you call a DJ today. But I was also running one of the departments there, which involved training new DJs and interacting with media and obviously buying some advertising. So it was during the time when ICASA was launching all these new licenses and a lot of community-based radio stations were cropping up all over the place, and I was part of that wave. From then, I joined the print media through a magazine, which was called E-Vibe at the time, which was a very small magazine, and I joined as a writer and eventually progressed to editor magazine. And I left that magazine and went to a newly formed magazine called YMAG, which at the time was had been launched in conjunction to a radio station called YFM in Gauteng. Still working in print. From there, I went into freelance a little bit. In fact, I'd actually joined YFM as a freelance writer before. So I had experience of freelance prior to that. And from then, I went to edit a magazine called Tribute, which unfortunately went into liquidation as soon as I joined, which was my luck, as usual. Which was interesting enough because when the magazine was liquidated, it was actually the first time we made a profit in 17 years of existence. And I thought we had a future. Back to freelance, and I'm basically doing print and all sorts of other things which are related to media, mostly commercially based. At the moment, I am editing that magazine. It's back on track. It's called Tribute, and I've been editing it for a year now. That's pretty much what I'm doing right now. Married, I've got one kid on the way.
Please just help us out, because we have to try to establish obviously some track record and some demonstration that you've been good in the field, the very field in which MDGA is active. So the Y magazine was therefore kind of an extra medium for YFM. How did it work? What was the formula? What kind of print runs did you have? What kind of circulation? Was it sold? That'll be one. How did that work? And while you were editing it, what performance measures can you therefore tell me how well it did? Then the other magazine that you mentioned, I'm not sure whether Blink or Blink, if it's Afrikaans, it's Blink and very shiny, but if it's in English, would you tell us about that? But on both Blink and Tribute, just give us an idea of the formula. Are these commercial products? In the case of Tribute, it arrives in my pigeonholes here, so I'm not sure whether the formula is that you distribute free to opinion makers or what. You must tell us what the formula is in each case, please. And then, depending on that formula, the performance measurements that arise, I think you must give us, because as you say, you are not yet 30. I think I saw somewhere that you had been a motoring journalist of the year. All right, so that means we know you can write about cars. That's great. But please give us an editor's, measure your own performance for us, if you kindly would.
Okay. Start off with the Y issue. Y magazine essentially started off as a youth-based, well, YFM itself is a youth. Based commercial radio station, hence the Y. It was funded using money from a company called ACI and a lot of other shareholders, their unions as well, which I believe they still are. So the YFM came first, and then it was a magazine a year later. The magazine was modeled after another magazine called SL, which used to have a life as a student life magazine. And it used to be distributed freely at universities, campuses, young people where, yes, Y and SL, where young people is together. And it was basically aimed at young people as a Y magazine. And some of the directors, I guess, saw potential in the growth and the commercial growth of the magazine, decided to make it a commercial magazine. And so the format changed. And I think that's where really it took off, because at some point it was selling about 5,000 copies, and at the peak of its existence it was selling about 18,000 copies, if I remember, which I suppose it's still going today, I'm not really sure. I wouldn't really say it was small, because the market at the time didn't exist. Fashion magazine trade really didn't have anything to be measured against. It was the only black, let's say, black youth-aimed magazine in the country. So the only other performance measurements we could use are other magazines which are not necessarily aimed at that market particularly. And in view of the fact that the market was shrinking, it was quite a success in that way. Yes, it still exists. I can't say it's making money or not. I'm not involved with it anymore. I just assume that it is, since it still exists. Blink magazine was started by a group of friends who had been looking for funding for such a magazine. It actually started when I was still freelancing. I was actually meant to contribute a column to them on a monthly basis. And one day I went through to deliver my column, and one of the management people didn't show up for some reason. They decided me to take his place in a meeting. After the meeting, they basically hired me to join the staff. The magazine actually received some really good reviews, but it did not sell. So there was no success in sales, particularly. Although it did receive a few awards. I think it kind of became too niche for whatever it was aiming for. It's obviously in the commercial sense of the word. And they actually decided that at some point it should become a community-based magazine. But unfortunately, when the whole board of management was dismantled before that plan had taken place. For some reason, we were not really told. So, well, Tribute is a brand that's been around for 20 years. The formula for Tribute is, it's aimed at people that are astute, people who are ambitious professionals, people who are like to read, people who are smart, and opinion makers and decision makers. It's partly freely distributed, and it's partly sold at certain retail outlets. We are printing about 10,000 copies at the moment, and because of the, you know, because of the type of magazine it is, we're selling about 6,000-7,000 of that. So we get retails about 4,000, and 1,000 of those are freely distributed to high schools and to other places where, let's say, PDIs, especially younger PDIs who are trying to get to read, in essence, and to have quality read, which is quite important for us. We're not really interested in just distributing stuff out there and for the sake of having it. We'd like people to be challenged mentally, not to read. We're actually making a bit of money now. I'm not sure why. I'm not a financial person. But I do believe it has to do with the revamp, the relook, totally different look, different ideas, different content. Tribute has a checkered history. I think some of you know, as soon as someone takes over Tribute, they change it and lose market share and gain other people and so on and so on. So it basically reflects the times.
Thank you, Chairperson. When I go through the CV, I've just made 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, more than 10 ticks on your motto, love of the motto, cars, not even writing about it. You have 2 certificates, advanced driving certificates. Now, MTDA, what has been your interest in it and what will be your contribution?
Okay. As you can see from my CV, I have a passion for media. And I think passion is not something that you can put down on paper. From the diversity of all the stuff that I've done, of all the organizations that I've worked on, it reflects media because I want to know how TV works, I want to know how radio works, how community radio works, how newspapers and magazines work. I want to know everything, how does print work, and so on and so forth. So, for me, one of the most important things as a boy who grew up in rural areas is that one of the first books that I ever read was sent through to me by a publisher that was actually based here in Cape Town. And she wrote them a letter and said, "We want a book in my school. Could you please send us books for us to read?" And, you know, my teachers, you know, in those days, you couldn't write anything without anybody looking at it first, and they had a look at the thing, and they were joking around about it. But a few weeks later, a box of books actually did arrive in the school, and the other children actually started reading with me. So for me, the whole thing about media power grew from that, to say, you know, we can actually make a change through reading, essentially. So I would like to say that through the MDDA, there is so much that can be done. I think because of the Act, first of all, Parliament realized that media in South Africa is not diverse enough. It's owned by a clique of elite people, and those elite people decide what goes on into the country, what gets published, what gets broadcast. And I think the MDA is very important to play a role in saying, look, the whole country needs access to media. And unfortunately, a lot of the rural-based people don't have access to media except for a few radio stations, and most of the radio stations are unfortunately as well commercial-based. So the work that the MDA does and can still do is seriously a challenge. And for my own part, I'm very interested in young people. As a young person myself, I believe that we have a vital role to play in this country as far as media is concerned, especially in terms of determining what media should present, and not just consuming media, which is what we've been doing all these years. We should create media for ourselves, to reflect ourselves, to speak to ourselves and say, these are the challenges that young people face on a daily basis. And you see that in most commercial media, you don't get that. There's a lot of frivolousness in reporting. There's a lot of sugarcoating. There's a lot of sensationalism, which I suppose sell papers and news stations. But a lot of it doesn't go to the core of who we should be as a country, what we should be working towards, and where our future lies, where the soul of the nation is.
I'm quite happy. Yes, I will throw my question. I'm happy.
The youth was represented.
Thank you very much.